Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
What if it's not a devil, but an angel in the details? What if the whole healthcare debate gets easier when we get more information and stop simplifying?
Tell me more. More and then some.
When they get into asking people about specific provisions, many polls show that people accept these provisions and want them and support them.
So give me all the dirty details, every little clause, every tax incentive, every factoid about pre-existing conditions.
I want some more and then some.
The more we know, the more we agree. Is it really that simple? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, February 24th. Todd Zwillick is with me for one more day. I get to enjoy your company before you head back down to Washington. John returns tomorrow.
Thanks, Celeste. Well, let's get right to some of the top stories we're following this morning, staying with the healthcare debate, where an idea that seemed toxic only a few weeks ago is gaining new steam with Democrats. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he may use a parliamentary shortcut called reconciliation to bypass Republicans and pass part of the healthcare bill. Republicans are complaining because the move would allow Democrats to pass the bill with just 51 votes, but Harry Reid says,
realistically, they should stop crying about reconciliation as if it's never been done before. It's done almost every Congress.
Reid says reconciliation has been used 21 times since 1981, and mostly by Republicans.
But that's the tactics. What about the substance of the health care bill? We're joined now by Republican Congressman Michael Burgess. He serves the 26th District of Texas that covers the Fort Worth area, and he also practiced obstetrics and gynecology for more than 20 years. Congressman, tell me, what's the number one thing that you think Congress can actually do to improve the health care system?
But the best thing we could do to improve the healthcare system would be get out of the way. But it doesn't look like we're going to do that. We have to find a way to make the purchaser of healthcare, the patient, actually put the power back in their hands. And nothing we are doing in any of the bills that are before us really moves us in that direction. In fact, if anything, we make the problem a little bit worse with greater expansion of administrative pricing and greater distancing between the patient, the physician, and whoever's making the healthcare decisions.
Okay, Congressman Burgess, stay with us. We'll be back with you in a moment.
Staying on Capitol Hill now, Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, has just arrived on Capitol Hill to testify at a House hearing on safety lapses and recalls at Toyota. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Bill Emmett, former editor at The Economist, who thinks Congress will go hard at Toyota's big boss.
They will appreciate that he's come all the way from Japan. However, this is a safety issue. It's an issue of populist politics as well.
Paul Eisenstein, the publisher of the DetroitBureau.com, was more explicit when he told us,
it won't be polite and it won't be easy. In fact, Mr. Toyota may again wonder why he did come to Washington.
Toyota's president is expected to apologize for the safety lapses.
Men's hockey is back today at the Winter Olympics. The United States is taking on Switzerland in men's hockey at 3 p.m. Eastern, then Russia and Canada in a big game face-off. That could be the gold medal game, not a quarterfinal. We're going to talk more with New York Times Olympics editor about that in just about 20 minutes. Looking at the markets, Asian markets are down. European indices are up. Futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,292. The S&P opens at 1,094 and the NASDAQ at 2213. Coming up, our series Frustration Nation continues. Being frustrated is one thing. A lot of you are frustrated, but do you have a solution? Some of our listeners have been giving us some answers to the gridlock, many of them using just six words, like Stephen in Fort Lauderdale, who says Democrats must call the Republicans bluff. Give us your fix at 8778-MYTAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org.
And we're talking healthcare throughout the show. We go to listeners across the country to hear what they think about the debate. They're joining us later in this hour, and in just a few minutes, we talk with two congressmen who are also doctors and get their takes. That's coming up in just a few minutes.
Good morning. I am joined for one morning, at least, by Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry. John comes back tomorrow. So tomorrow we're going to have a bipartisan healthcare summit in Washington. And everyone's watching to see if there's really going to be some bipartisanship going on. President Obama had this message for Republicans in a speech in Nevada last week.
Show me what you got. But don't let the American people go another year, another 10 years, another 20 years without health insurance reform in this country.
Joining us now are two lawmakers who also are doctors. Republican Congressman Michael Burgess serves the 26th District of Texas, including the Fort Worth area. He practiced obstetrics and gynecology for more than 20 years. And Congressman Jim McDermott is a Democratic representative from Washington, a trained psychiatrist, and the longest-serving physician in Congress. Later in the hour, Congressman, we're going to be talking to three folks from around the country who are listening in right now, and they're going to respond to what you both say. So be careful. Your constituents are listening. But first off, good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Congressman, we all of us know that the Americans are extremely frustrated with the arguments and what they see as gridlock going on in Washington right now. So I want to make a deal with both of you. Let's talk about the health care bill, not just the bill, but health care reform in a positive way today. I want to completely leave behind any statements about things that we might oppose in the bill. We're going to make a deal that all we're going to talk about today are solutions that you support, okay?
Okay. Okay, let's go to solutions.
Okay, let's start with you, Congressman Burgess. Let's go to rate hikes first, because we've been hearing a lot about Anthem Blue Cross in California, which, in spite of record profits, is raising its premium rates by 39%. People across the country are complaining about the skyrocketing costs of their insurance premiums. How do we fix it?
You know, this is interesting because we've got this, we actually have them coming into our oversight hearing today. And what is unclear to me from the documents that have been provided to me beforehand, California, where this occurred, actually has a prohibition against raising rates unless you can confirm that with actuarial data. What we're going to be missing from this hearing is the Commissioner of Insurance from California, who I guess is running for other political office. Did they approve that or not is really becomes the central question. We already have a system to prevent that from happening. Do we need to create a new federal system? And if we do, why? And how could we make that better? I'm not convinced that's absolutely necessary, but at the same time, you're right, 40% is a scary number, and in some ways, you wonder if this happened completely by accident, that this rate hike came in right on the eve of this summit.
Congressman Burgess from Texas with possible conspiracy theories. Jim McDermott out of Washington, what do you think about rate hikes? How do we fix them?
Well, the rate hike issue was set in place in Medicare, certainly, and that is the population in which most of the health care dollars are spent. When we decided that we would pay usual and customary fees and we would get away from any kind of regulation. It was a mistake made in the 1965. And the only way really to get that is to get back to some kind of real regulation of rates, of costs of health care. And it's not easy to do. I've been doing this too long to think that you can have some magic answer here. But I do think that it is possible. Other countries, France, for instance, for half the money that we spend in the United States, uses regulation to control their health care costs. And it's possible to do, but you have to be vigorous. In this case, the Congress has been irregularly interested in doing this.
Not often interested. Okay, you guys have probably seen the poll results out showing that when Americans are asked about specific provisions in much of the health care reform, they actually support them by large numbers, and I mean 60% to 70%, talking about health insurance exchange, getting rid of restrictions on pre-existing conditions, closing that donut hole in Medicare that makes seniors responsible for paying for their own drugs for a period of time. But they are confused about the entire bill and react negatively. So tell me, Congressman Burgess, let's start with you. Of the provisions that most Americans support, which do you also support?
There are about 7 or 9 things that we could all agree on and do.
Okay, give me two or three of them.
The first thing that when I heard from my constituents over the summer at the town hall, we don't like what you're doing, but would you please do something about pre-existing conditions? And in fact, we do have things that there are bills out there already written that would help with this. Again, for whatever reason, we've decided not to go there. The proposal, and here's the tough part too, because all these great things that the president is talking about doing is we're not going to get any of those till 2014, 2015 under the best of circumstances. But we can start tomorrow on just essentially insurance reform to begin to get around the problem of pre-existing conditions. You do that by risk pools. You do that by reinsurance. 34 states already have programs set up. Perhaps we're not funding them appropriately. Maybe that is one direction we could go. Congressional Budget Office said it would take about $25 billion over 10 years to do this. That number may be a little bit light, but
this is progress, Congressman Burgess. Congressman McDermott, you just heard your colleague say that at least on pre-existing conditions, when you guys meet in the summit tomorrow, you can find some consensus on that.
Well, actually, we'll have a chance to do it before tomorrow. On the floor of the House today, Mike and I'll have an opportunity to vote on the repeal of the McCarran-Ferguson Act, which gave monopolistic power to the insurance companies in the sense of not being available to be regulated by federal law. We've given that to the states all these years, and the mess is created, and now we have an opportunity to change that today. So we'll see by 9 o'clock tonight whether or not the Republicans really are serious about changing the law that protects insurance companies. They say they are, and I hope they are.
That's Congressman Jim McDermott, a Democrat from Washington, and Congressman Michael Burgess, a Republican from Texas. They're both physicians. We're going to get some listener views who've been listening in just about less than an hour, but what's your take?
This is Vince from Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. Regarding the so-called bipartisan summit, I think it looks a lot more like a show trial or a political stunt or a propaganda fest than any real substantive exchange. I think it's orchestrated by the administration to make some political points, and that's really about all it's for.
You can reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. If you can't get anything accomplished in terms of agreement at a bipartisan summit, where does it happen?
In the back room, frankly. That's where the deals get made, even if they're bipartisan on camera.
And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in now on the headlines.
Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, will testify today in a congressional investigation into his company's safety issues. He's also expected to address family members of four people killed in a car crash thought to have been caused by one of those safety issues, sticky gas pedals. One family member, Joseph Ordahl, says his relatives are devastated. He says his aunt will express the family's grief at hearings this morning.
She's the face of this recall, and we just want to put a human element to the tragedy.
Adal was speaking on CBS News this morning.
A math teacher in Denver, Colorado, is credited with stopping a shooting at a middle school. The teacher, David Benke, explains what happened when he approached the shooter.
At first, when I was walking over there, it was kind of, you know, what a teacher does when they walk over and they say, hey, kid, you know, what are you doing?
Teacher tackled the shooter just after two teenage students were hit. Those students were taken to a local hospital and are expected to survive. The Census Bureau is defending its decision to spend $300 million to promote the national headcount. Department head Robert Groves told a Senate panel he knows the government is facing tough times, but the paid advertising is crucial for a successful count. Finally, the U.S. has renewed a travel alert for people heading to Mexico. The State Department says increasing violence from drug wars has prompted them to extend their warnings through August of 2010. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, more about Toyota's president and his appearance before Congress. He is on Capitol Hill as we speak. And you have a right to remain silent or not talk or not use oral language. However you say it, Miranda rights still okay by the Supreme Court.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some takeouts on the stories we're following this week. Money and politics. Toyota executives, of course, back on Capitol Hill today for questions about recalls. They're there all week. But money and politics, you have to follow the money on Capitol Hill. David Leventhal is communications director for the Center for Responsive Politics. He joins us now. His organization tracks lobbying money, congressional campaigns, and where lawmakers get their money. Dave, is there a conflict of interest with Toyota from some of the lawmakers that are going to be questioning Toyota executives today?
There's certainly a very large intersection between Toyota and the federal government, and there are some lawmakers who, for example, have had stock holdings in Toyota. And one of them, Jane Harman, a representative from California, actually recused herself just last night, saying that she's not going to take part in the debate because, at least in 2008, the most recent records we have, she had hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of Toyota stock.
Now, this is why we have disclosure. So I suppose it would be one thing if these were private, but what about Toyota's lobbying? How much do they spend in support of members?
Toyota is actually the largest lobbyer among all foreign automakers, bigger than Honda, bigger than Volkswagen, and only General Motors and Ford has actually lobbied the federal government to a greater degree over the past 5 years. In all, Toyota has spent about $25 million on federal lobbying efforts. That's in addition to money that its employees associated with Toyota have given directly to candidates in the form of campaign contributions.
Clearly something to keep in mind as we're watching the hearings today, lawmakers with personal interest in Toyota and also Toyota with an interest in lawmakers. David Leventhal, Communications Director for the Center for Responsive Politics.
And now let's get another takeout from Vancouver and the Winter Olympics. Jason Stallman is covering it for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning.
Okay, so for the Olympics today, let's start with Lindsey Vonn, already a gold medalist from this Winter Olympics, but she could possibly get another one in an event today.
Lindsey's skiing an event today. You know, she's had a few days off, so she's kind of like drifted out of everyone's attention for a little bit, and she's back in the giant slalom. This is not an event that she's been particularly strong in. In fact, her teammate, Julia Mancuso, who also has a couple medals here in Vancouver, she's a little bit better at this event than Vonn is. So the Americans could come away with a medal, but don't be surprised if it's not Lindsey Vonn.
Okay, but the big news, at least for me, but I'm sure for lots and lots of people, are the hockey quarterfinals. And this is exciting on both the men's side and on the women's side. What's going on?
Well, on the men's side, you have what many people would have called a gold medal game coming into the Olympics. It was pretty well understood that Canada and Russia were fielding the best teams, and they were expected to ultimately meet for the gold medal. Canada had some troubles in their early round, so now they're having to face Russia in the quarterfinals after beating Germany today. So that's going to be a big showdown. You know, when Canada played the United States on Sunday, that was the highest-rated sporting event in television history in Canada. They said that 2 out of 3 Canadians were watching that game, and I have to believe at least that many are going to be watching Canada-Russia today.
The exciting thing for me as we start getting closer in is that, you know, there's a chance that both the women and the men's U.S. teams could be vying for a gold in hockey.
This is true. On the women's side, Canada and the United States clearly are far superior than the rest of the competition. So they're in the semifinals now playing different opponents, and they'll almost certainly meet in the finals, and one of them is going to come away with a gold medal.
It's very exciting. Jason Stallman, Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times.
And now on to Washington and the Supreme Court. You have a right to remain silent. You have a right to an attorney. If you cannot afford one, an attorney will be appointed to you. I'm trying to quote the Miranda warning that we're all familiar with. Now, it turns out that you don't have to do it exactly. After a 7-2 decision at the Supreme Court yesterday, apparently police can now ad-lib Miranda rights.
You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to a court-appointed attorney.
You have the right to sing the blues. You have the right to cable TV. That's very important. You have the right to sublet. You have the right to paint the walls. No loud colors.
All right. They may not want to get that far afield, but here to explain the Supreme Court decision and the reasoning behind it is Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Now, Adam, maybe not the right to paint the walls and sing the blues, but what was the court saying yesterday?
The court says that the Miranda warnings are really principles. It's not a form that is written out in the Constitution, but a series of principles. And so long as the police give you those principles, those ideas well enough, the Supreme Court's not going to give you a form, a card that you actually have to read from. The question in the case whether police in Tampa, and they had a little form of their own, got it right when they did say two things. They said, you have the right to talk to a lawyer before answering any of our questions. That's fine. But then they didn't go on to say you have a right to have a lawyer with you when we ask you questions, or that you have a right to ask for a lawyer once we start asking questions. The Supreme Court said that was close enough because at the end of the warning there was this kind of little catch-all phrase, you have the right to use any of these rights. at any time during the interview, and they thought that criminals are smart enough to say, that must mean I have a right to a lawyer with me at the interview.
All right, well, we had the comedy Police Academy 2 at the top, which is obviously not the real world. But in the real world, Adam Liptak from the New York Times, it seems that if it's just principles officers have to impart, that they may be opening themselves up to many more legal challenges because principles are so murky. Aren't we going to see a lot more cases now about principles of Miranda?
Well, cops will probably still be safer if they either go back to the original Miranda decision and more or less use the language in there, or interestingly, the Supreme Court said that you can do it better than Miranda. It said the FBI does it the best of all, and the FBI actually has some very plain English language. It says, and this doesn't sound like the Miranda warnings, but it sounds pretty good. You have the right to talk to a lawyer for advice before we ask you any questions. You have the right to have a lawyer with you during questioning. Now, that's plain English. It doesn't sound like what you hear on the cop shows. It actually sounds a little bit better. The Supreme Court's point is it's not going to micromanage how cops do it, but it wants at least the concepts to be put across. And I guess the other thing I'd say is that people have seen this on TV enough times that it doesn't really matter how you tell it to them because they've already heard it.
They've already heard it, and they may already know their rights, or at least we hope they do, but police still have to inform you of your rights. It's your constitutional right. Adam Liptak of the New York Times Supreme Court correspondent, thanks for joining us. Coming up, our series Frustration Nation continues. Is the media to blame for congressional gridlock? We got a lot of reactions from you, and we take a closer look at what you think. That's in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on some top stories at 31 minutes past the hour. Toyota President Akio Toyoda is now on Capitol Hill to answer questions about the company's safety lapses. He's also expected to apologize to American consumers. Elsewhere on Capitol Hill, the Senate is expected to pass a jobs bill today. Among the provisions is a tax break for companies that hire the unemployed. New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer tells MSNBC this morning he hopes this will kickstart bipartisan cooperation.
I think that Republicans are seeing in their polling that just being the party of no is not going to work. We may have a much better bipartisan year this year than last.
Five Republicans broke ranks with their party yesterday to support the jobs bill.
Federal investigators would want to use black box recordings to monitor pilot conversations. It's the first time that workplace monitoring would extend to the nation's cockpits. Until now, black box recorders have only been used in accident investigations. And Major League Baseball says it'll implement blood testing for human growth hormone in the minor leagues this year. The players' union had resisted blood testing, but it's the only way to identify HGH users who use it to build muscles and recover from injury. And a new study says doctors are cutting back on their hours. The report says doctors went from averaging 55 hours a week to 51 hours over the past decade. In the past 10 years, there's been a 25% decline in doctors' pay as well. And Twitter has found itself a new kind of follower, the Dalai Lama. The Tibetan spiritual leader joined Twitter after meeting this week with the company's founder. In 2 days, he's got 100,000 followers. If you want to tweet him, his Twitter address is @DalaiLama.
Simple enough.
Very easy to remember. The markets are open on Wall Street. It looks like the Dow is...
Where are those numbers?
We are going to have to get back to it in just a moment. It looks like
there they are.
There they are. The Dow is up 37 points. The Nasdaq's up about 13. And the S&P is up about 7 points as well. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
There is much too much ideology, not enough practical progress.
People are angry, and they are frustrated that perhaps it hasn't been a fast enough change.
Even at a time of enormous national challenge, the people's business is not getting done.
I don't want you to feel discouraged.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
All this week, we've been having conversations about gridlock in Washington. It's the series we're calling Frustration Nation. Yesterday, we talked about the role of the media and whether we in the media perpetuate the political divisiveness in Washington that's stagnating our politics in Washington and across the country overall. Now, a lot of you called us at 8778-MY-TAKE and went to the website, thetakeaway.org, about the topic. And we want to get your reactions now because some of them were really telling. Here's Isaac.
This is Isaac calling from Riverdale, New York. The media is responsible for having put us through the Iraq War, the second one, and it's because of the media that we're in the economic situation that we're in right now because of their faulty coverage of Wall Street.
And Celeste, I think what Isaac is saying there is about sins of omission, that the media has not done its job, and that resulted in things like not uncovering discrepancies in things like weapons of mass destruction or malfeasance on Wall Street that have led to these problems.
Well, if you believe that one of the missions of a free press is to act as a watchdog of government and corporations, then, you know, there are many things that have been sins of omission among the media, I'm perfectly willing to admit. And it's an important point, and I believe a lot of people feel that when they say it's the media's fault. We're wondering if Americans are just as angry with the media as they are with the government. And we've come, and have we actually come to a point where people have a hard time separating the two? Yesterday we spoke with Kathleen Hall Jamieson. She's with the Annenberg Public Policy Center. And she talked about how headline-driven news is changing the way Americans consume the news.
The media are able to digest complex issues in short segments if they want to. A Republican plan, you'll be able to buy insurance across state lines. Democratic plan, you'll be able to carry your insurance until you're 26 if you're a student. The complexities of plans can be reduced to short segments.
And in there she was responding to my question about, do we have to have two people from both sides of the aisle arguing with each other? So she's saying, no, you can actually really give people the substance of the health care plan in short segments if you want to do that. But Anne from Massachusetts emails us, we depend on the media to call politicians out for misstatements and lies. The health care reform issue is an example. We hear most Americans are happy with their insurance. Then we hear 30 million people are without health insurance. So clarify what that means. We can actually clarify that for you right now, Anne from Massachusetts. Those are both correct.
They're both true things, and it's one of the complexities of the healthcare debate. Most people have coverage and like it, and
but
a lot of people don't.
Explain. What we're talking about here, Anne, is that, and you're right, it can be extremely confusing. Most people in America have healthcare. The problem is, yes, that means there are millions and millions of Americans who do not have health care. Those who do have health care, those who get health care through their employer, for the most part, are happy with what they have. But that there's also another issue out there, which is that even those people who have health care that comes from their employer or another place feel like there's room for reform in the healthcare system.
And those two groups tend to be at odds, and that can be tough for the media to cover, and maybe the media doesn't always cover those two groups of concerns very well. Now, here's another listener upset with what she's been reading and hearing.
This is Marcia from the Boston area. I hold the media very responsible, not for creating problems, but for making them go on and for making them worse. The media should be reading the health care plan and reporting what it says. The media should be investigating when the Republicans or Democrats make claims against each other that aren't truthful and reporting on the truth.
Now, I can tell you, Celeste, that my colleagues, at least on Capitol Hill, most of them do sit down, literally, and delve through 850 pages of a health care bill. They do read it, and they do try to impart it, but I think they find difficulty, frankly, when they get to their editors or producers or looking for airtime, to really explain everything they think should be explained about it.
Well, but what often ends up happening, and this is the question for me, is that when you're striving for balance, when you're going to sources and you speak with one Democratic congressman, and then you're required to speak to the Republican congressman, and they're both giving you oftentimes spin. They're trained to spin their answers. Are they not? They
sure.
go through
well,
extensive
they're media,
training.
They're media professionals themselves.
Absolutely. So the problem is that the media should be distilling that. We should be acknowledging that what we're getting from congressmen oftentimes is spin and not straight talk express,
right.
And then giving them the real answer. I think that last final piece where we say, here's what they said, but here's the actual truth of it, because oftentimes you can establish truth.
You can, and billboards are difficult. For instance, death panels, which is a famous example, there was no such thing, and yet there were provisions that were being called death panels, and when you got into the explanation of what they were really talking about, it got very murky, and it was people's opinions that came through.
It got murky, but there was no such thing as death panel. There are a few people who came out actually to defend the media. Al emails, blaming the media is merely scapegoating. Most people search out information they want to hear, not what they want to learn. The fact is, when people don't like the information, they blame the messenger. The health issue is a perfect example. Most Americans who have insurance, even when they overpay for it, don't want it to change. So they don't want to hear anything about needing to change. Most people always want issues explained to them, handed to them, already digested, and do not want to have to do any of the work at actually attempting to understand complex issues. And that's because they are lazy. They blame the media.
I think that Al's point has – I think that Al has a good point, and I said this yesterday, and I'd like to repeat it. The media has a lot of responsibility, and we in the media, it's our responsibility to check ourselves constantly. Are we informing less than entertaining? Are we fact-checking? Are we holding ourselves accountable? However, I believe the public in general, just like their politicians, gets the media they deserve. If you really think the media that you're consuming isn't performing, change the channel, turn the page, and you should do the same with politicians. If they're not performing, vote them out. And I think the same principle holds true. They're both public institutions that are very important.
Well, we always want to get your takes on what you hear on The Takeaway. You can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post on our site, thetakeaway.org. We're going to be talking more about healthcare in the days to come, but we're also going to be talking more about it later this hour. We spoke to two congressmen earlier this hour, two congressmen who also happen to be doctors, Burgess from Texas and McDermott from Washington State. And we had some listeners listening in on that conversation. We're going to get their reactions later on. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. The president of the Japanese car automaker Toyota is about to appear before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee today. As Congress looks into Toyota's recall of millions of vehicles, they're talking about sudden acceleration problems that have been blamed for about 30 U.S. deaths. The most high-profile appearance is going to come today when Akio Toyoda appears before Congress. He's the president of the largest company in Japan. But how is this being reported, the recalls, Akio Toyoda's appearance, how is it going over in Japan? To answer that, we have Michael Chuchek. He's an American blogger and a research analyst who's lived in Japan for more than 15 years, and he joins us now from Tokyo. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So you have some papers in front of you?
Yes, I have the copy of all of these morning's papers, yeah.
And what are the headlines as Akio Toyoda heads to Congress today?
Well, it depends. If you're on the right, on the conformist conservative side of the political spectrum, there's a great deal of concern about what this all means for the U.S.-Japan security relationship. So these conservative newspapers are tending to play up a sense of concern or even fear about a deterioration of that relationship. On the other hand, the business press, quite interestingly, is rather sanguine about the whole affair. National Business Daily, the Nihon Keizai Shimbun, didn't have the story as its top story this morning. So they seem to take the attitude that recalls and defects are just part of doing business.
What has been kind of the attitude among in coverage and among the Japanese people about this whole recall in the United States? Do they feel the U.S. is blowing it out of proportion? Do they feel Toyota is unfairly targeted?
That's a really touchy thing to say because you don't want to appear to be reacting to the United States' actions. But nevertheless, there is a sense that Mr. Toyota today is walking into a lion's den at the U.S. Congress and that the best he can hope for is to not get too badly mauled. The nation's papers, all the business ones, have all said that this is not really so much a hearing as a political show. Seiji no show is the term they use, and that this is an election year in the United States, and that congressmen and women are going to try to make a good impression on television for their constituents.
I've heard it said by several people that public apologies have a very different tenor to them in Japan than they do in the United States. Many of Toyota's executives have been apologizing publicly, and Akio Toyoda is expected to do that today. How is that seen in Japan?
Well, the apology is always expected. The only difference is that in this case, there is no consumer, or there was no consumer protection agency in Japan until very recently. And as a consequence, there isn't a familiarity with dealing with consumers very, very hopped up and with the government behind them. Basically, the companies have been facing the consumers by themselves, and it's an unfair fight.
Okay, that is Michael Chuchek. He's the author of the Shishaku blog on Japanese politics and society. He joins us from Tokyo taking a look at the headlines. Kind of interesting that the business papers in Japan aren't carrying it as the top headline.
I found that shocking.
President, I mean, Toyota is the largest company in Japan. It is interesting, however, Akio Toyoda appearing before Congress today. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee. I'm joined here by Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry, at least until tomorrow. John will return on Thursday. Coming up a little bit more in our healthcare discussion, we spoke a little earlier this hour with two congressmen, a Democrat and a Republican, both doctors, and we had some listeners listening in, and they're going to respond to what they heard in just a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The Senate is expected to pass a $35 billion jobs bill today. The bill would offer tax breaks to companies that hire unemployed workers. And during congressional hearings today, Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, is expected to take full responsibility for his company's safety recalls. He's also expected to apologize to customers. And a math teacher in Denver is credited with stopping a shooting at a middle school yesterday. Deer Creek Middle School student Kevin Zwolinski told Fox News what he saw.
I didn't know what it was. I was kind of confused still, and I turned around and I saw everyone running, and then he fired a second shot. That kid, he was on the, I looked over there and he was on the ground.
Two students were shot there in the hospital, though they're expected to survive.
Moving on to Afghanistan, the U.S. military plans to spend more than $600 million to build nearly 200 police stations for the Afghan police in the coming year. And at the Olympics today, the women's bobsled finals are on the agenda, and the U.S. is running for a medal in the event. Bobsled competitor Erin Pack, she's a pilot. She's currently in second place, and she says she can't afford any mistakes.
The track is very tricky, and, you know, there's a lot of curves that you know, you make a mistake in one, it gets you three down. So you just have to hold on and ride sometimes.
And steer. The women's bobsled finals are at 6:15 p.m. Eastern time this evening. Today's events also include ladies' alpine skiing and men's ice hockey quarterfinals. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, President Obama will hold a bipartisan summit tomorrow about health care. Both House and Senate leaders will be there. Earlier this hour, we spoke with two lawmakers from the House who also happen to be physicians, Jim McDermott, a Democrat from Washington State, and Michael Burgess, a Republican from Texas. And we wanted to bring this discussion back full circle from the lawmakers in Washington back to the public that they serve. We have three friends of the Takeaway with us. Rashonda Young joined us last summer for one of our healthcare roundtable discussions. She's the operations manager of Alpha Express. That's a small business in Waterloo, Iowa. Steve Rose, Takeaway listener from Detroit. He called in to actually comment on the healthcare debate, and we liked what he had to say. And Dr. Peter Sinton, he commented on our website about the cost of healthcare. He's a pediatrician and co-owns a practice in Ponco, Oklahoma. Good morning to all three of you.
Good morning.
Steve, I wanted to start with you, and I wanted to play for you a comment that Congressman Burgess made. He serves the 26th District of Texas. He was talking about things that he would support in terms of insurance reform, and one way he thought was by sending it back to the states. Here's what he had to say.
We could start tomorrow on just essentially insurance reform to begin to get around the problem of pre-existing conditions. You do that by risk pools, you do that by reinsurance. 34 states already have programs set up. Perhaps we're not funding them appropriately. Maybe that is one direction we could go.
A restriction, I mean, keeping people from losing insurance or not being able to get insurance because of a pre-existing condition has broad public support. Do you support a not having pre-existing condition restrictions?
I think that's a reasonable, requirement. Especially going forward, if this plan is going to go forward, I don't think it's unreasonable. I think there has to be some protections for insurance providers, and we can't just unload every cost that they might incur without giving it some thoughtful consideration and review.
Okay, you just heard Michael Burgess saying that there's certain programs already in place in many states that address some insurance problems. Do you think that the states already have some of these answers?
Well, I think if 34 states, what's that, two-thirds of the country already have something in place, they must be onto something. And the people in Washington who think that the government knows best, that the federal government knows better than the states, maybe they should take a look at what the states are doing.
Okay, Rashonda Young, let me go to you. You're the operations manager of a small business, and you've had trouble being able to afford health care for your employees.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, you know, when you initially turn in your applications and you get your initial quote, you get rates that are reasonable, then they look at the health of each person on the plan, and they start excluding, you know, pre-existing conditions, and they, you know, double what you were initially quoted. It's not reasonable or affordable for small businesses.
Can you give me an idea of what some of these premiums cost for your business, for an employee?
For example, for an individual plan, initial quotes, you know, coming back at $241, that's not bad. But once you get health questionnaires in, an individual will cost you over $400 a month. A family, which is initially quoted at $500 and some, is almost $1,000 a month. That's a lot of money for a small business to be able to afford.
Okay, both of the congressmen addressed this issue of rate hikes and the cost of premiums. Did you hear something that you liked?
In terms of the rate hikes, definitely I believe that having a federal overseer so that the rate hikes can only go up, you know, at a reasonable percentage is definitely a must. The insurance companies have not been fair. They've had plenty of time to prove, you know, whether or not they can do this on their own, and they haven't proven that they can.
Okay, now let's go to you, Peter Sinton. You're a pediatrician in rural Oklahoma. Both of the congressmen we spoke to were also doctors. You have 80% of your patients qualify for Medicaid. What about the other 20%?
The other 20% typically have some type of private insurance, and then a small percent are self-pay or cash pay. But because of the whole rate hikes of the change in the structure of how people are insured now, the people that are supposedly insured with private insurance actually have very high deductibles and therefore are basically self-pay. And, you know, as the two congressmen know, if they were practicing physicians, that, you know, when you have self-pay patients, you rely on you know, you're kind of caught between being an altruistic physician and being a business person, which I don't like being a business person.
Okay. Did you hear something from the congressman? We heard from someone from Texas, Michael Burgess, and also the congressman from Washington State, a Democrat. Did you hear anything that gave you faith that they understand what's really at issue here and that we could get some bipartisan cooperation during the summit tomorrow?
I don't think there's going to be cooperation. I think some of the core issues of insurance reform and affecting, you know, how we get premiums down is really distasteful to the Republicans. I think they want the market system to correct us. They want competition. You know, I remember McCain talking about during the election, talking about let's get competition between states, and that's a fair thing to suggest. The other thing I think they've suggested is cooperatives, which costs an enormous amount of capital, and if you get, you know, just a group of people together, I mean, you know, they're not coming up with the kind of capital to support a non-for-profit cooperative of health coverage. So I think we're rather stuck with insurance companies because they have the basis, the capital to fund, you know, sick patients and well patients, like they said, patients with pre-existing conditions.
Okay, let me ask you, Dr. Peter Sinton, a pediatrician from Oklahoma, yes or no, have you written your congressman or senator about this?
Oh, yeah. Emailed.
Rashonda Young in Iowa, have you written your congressman or senator?
I sure have.
Okay, Steve Rose from Detroit, are you still there?
Yes.
Have you written your congressman or senator about this?
Yes, I have.
I'm Celeste. That's three of our listeners, actually. I am Celeste Headley. Three of our listeners who joined us, they were listening in on the conversation earlier that we had with two congressmen, and those are their responses. All three of them have written to either their senators or their congressmen, and it's a question of whether that's being received on Capitol Hill. I guess we might find out during the bipartisan summit tomorrow. Steve Rose, a listener from Detroit. Rashonda Young, operations manager of a family-run business in Waterloo, Iowa. And Dr. Peter Sinton, pediatrician from Ponca City, Oklahoma. Thanks to all three of you. You can catch up on all of the healthcare coverage or anything you've missed by going to our site. It's thetakeaway.org.
And while you're there, check out while you're on thetakeaway.org, click on blog, because Takeaway producer Noel King has an interesting feature. You've been hearing about how we've hit 1,000 U.S. casualties in Afghanistan. Turns out that number is a lot harder to know than you think. It's both lower and harder to pin down, so make sure you check out thetakeaway.org. For our series, The Frustration Nation, it continues today, too, on the web. Being frustrated is one thing, but how about a solution? Some of our listeners have been giving us their answers to gridlock, some in just six words. Mike in Colorado posted to the site, term limits, no filibuster, limits on lobbyists, limit campaign contributions, and more open government. That's not six words, but it's close. Well, it's pretty close. 8778-MY-TAKE, thetakeaway.org.
What does close mean to you, Todd?
Well,
that's not very close. I'm Celeste
20.
Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. It's The Takeaway.
Go, go, Todd Zwillick!
Toyota on the hot seat.
After 6 miles, God intervened. With the car stopped and both feet still on the brake, the motor still revved up and down.
That's Rhonda Smith talking yesterday about her Toyota. Whether or not God intervened, Congress has intervened. Lawmakers want to know what Toyota knew and when they knew it. And yesterday, Toyota started giving answers.
We've done extensive testing on this system, and we've never found a malfunction that's caused unintended acceleration.
Lawmakers have plenty of legislating to do this week, but the real show is in the hearing rooms as Toyota executives go on trial. Today, the big boss is called to the carpet all the way from Japan. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, February 24th. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. He'll be back tomorrow, and I'm here with Celeste.
Good morning. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. More now on Toyota's walk through the Capitol Hill fire pit. Here's Congressman Henry Waxman grilling Toyota's U.S. President James Lentz yesterday.
Do you believe that the recall on the carpet changes and the recall on the sticky pedal will solve the problem of sudden unintended acceleration?
Not totally.
Lentz also apologized repeatedly for the safety problems that led to the worldwide recall, saying the company lost sight of the customer.
Now that sets the stage for Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, the grandson of the company's founder, to testify before Congress today. We're joined now by Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Now, based on what you saw of the treatment that James Lentz, the North American president of sales, got yesterday in front of Congress, what kind of treatment do you think Akio Toyoda, the big boss, is going to get today?
It won't be polite and it won't be easy. In fact, Mr. Toyoda may again wonder why he did come to Washington. As you know, last week he was saying that he probably wouldn't and would let his American executives handle the mess here in the States. Well, I think he's going to be thinking that he probably should have stayed home.
Well, Paul Eisenstein, stay with us because we're going to be following those hearings and looking ahead to the hearings in just a bit, so stay with us.
Staying on Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he may use a parliamentary shortcut called reconciliation to bypass Republicans and pass a health care bill. Republicans are complaining because the move would allow Democrats to pass the bill with just 51 votes. But Reid says,
realistically, they should stop crying about reconciliation as if it's never been done before. It's done almost every Congress.
Reid says reconciliation has been used 21 times since 1981, mostly by Republicans. In Greece this morning, police in Athens have fired tear gas on demonstrators protesting the government's austerity measures. Up to 2 million people are participating in a general strike after the government announced a wave of belt tightening to reduce a ballooning budget deficit that's affected the rest of the Eurozone. And in Haiti, the last two American missionaries still held on child kidnapping charges are expected to be freed soon.
At the Winter Olympics in Vancouver, the U.S. leads the medal count with 26, followed by Germany with 23 and Norway with 17. We'll talk more with the New York Times Olympic editor in just about 20 minutes. Moving to the markets now, Asian markets are down, European indices are mixed, and futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,292, the S&P opens at 1,094, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,213. Coming up in the show, we talk food every Wednesday. How much do expiration dates really matter, those labels on your food? They might matter a little bit less than you think, and we'll talk more about that later in the hour.
Our series, Frustration Nation, continues today. Being frustrated is one thing. We've heard you're frustrated, but do you have a solution? Some of us have been giving us answers to the gridlock. Doug in Gillette, Wyoming, posts to our site, "Stop calling Americans stupid and listen." Give us your fix at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're going to talk more about the congressional hearings about Toyota and look forward to Akio Toyota's appearance today in Congress in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here in for John Hockenberry. He'll be back tomorrow. Toyota is, meanwhile, answering a lot of tough questions about safety recalls this week on Capitol Hill. Today, the company's CEO, Akio Toyoda, will testify before the House Oversight Committee. Yesterday, it was Consumers' chance to speak, along with some other Toyota executives. One after the other, Toyota owners sat down and related startling experiences with their vehicles, like a tearful woman named Rhonda Smith, a driver whose car suddenly accelerated back in 2006.
After 6 miles, God intervened. As the car came very slowly to a stop, I pulled it to the left median. With the car stopped and both feet still on the brake, the motor still revved up and down.
That was Rhonda Smith, Toyota owner. Also called to the carpet yesterday was James Lentz. He is president of North American sales for Toyota. That means he's the boss in North America. And he was called on the carpet in front of the congressional committee yesterday. Paul Eisenstein from the DetroitBureau.com is back with us. Paul, James Lentz, did he provide satisfying answers on the cause of sudden accelerations in Toyotas and what might be done to fix them?
No, anything but. In fact, the testimony that Lentz provided seemed more guaranteed to keep him out of jail. As you know, there are now criminal investigations looking at Toyota than it did necessarily to save the company. What you come away with is the recognition that Toyota is essentially saying that the two recalls it has in place right now for accelerator problems will only directly address perhaps 30% or so of the complaints it's received. Now, the maker continues to insist that it doesn't have an electronics issue and that it has fully tested this. Yet we saw testimony from a Professor Gilbert of Southern Illinois University, which raises questions about that. Is he credible? We don't know. But it certainly threw into tatters the calm assertions by Mr. Lentz that they are in charge here.
But also when James Lentz was asked whether the planned fixes to software and carpets would fix acceleration problems, he said he wasn't sure.
Exactly. And that's the problem. They've been saying all along, we've all been watching television or reading the papers and seeing and hearing them calmly assert, we are in control. We have isolated the problem and we're going to fix it. That claim. He said one of his comments during his original testimony was, the solutions we have developed are both effective and durable. Yet by the end of the day, they appeared less durable than his own testimony. What's really scary, though, is that what we're now seeing is a company that seems enmeshed in secrecy. We've had huge problems with safety over here, and yet, according to Mr. Lentz, it appears that American officials were kept in the dark, that virtually all the key decisions were handled out of Japan. And as we heard from Ray LaHood not all that long ago, it appears that the people in Japan were very reluctant to take the steps that they needed to. They had to plead with them to do the second recall. This is not a good sign for a company that bills itself as safe and reliable and an American company.
Now, as we look forward now to the testimony of Akio Toyoda, who is the big boss coming over from Japan, based on the treatment that you saw for James Lentz yesterday, you expect the big boss, as I'm calling him, to get withering treatment or something a little more deferential?
I don't think Toyota-san will have an easy time. There are a lot of questions that were left unanswered yesterday or the answers left in tatters. And I think that the second committee, members of the second committee, they're going to smell blood from what happened yesterday and go after it vigorously.
You say smell blood, Paul Eisenstein, finally, but is there a measure of political grandstanding on Capitol Hill? It's kind of the coin of the realm. Or are they really getting to the bottom of things?
Well, there's a lot of grandstanding here, but the fact is Toyota is coming across as a very vulnerable company that did not live up to its own promises. That's going to lead to grandstanding, but it's also going to lead to some serious questions.
More hearings today on Capitol Hill with Toyota. Paul Eisenstein from the DetroitBureau.com will be watching. Paul, thank you. Now we want to turn to Bill Emmett, the former editor of The Economist. He spent many years in Japan covering that country, and he knows a thing or two about Akio Toyoda, the president of Worldwide Toyota, who's going to be on Capitol Hill today. Bill, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Bill, tell us a little bit about the man, Akio Toyoda. He'll be testifying today in front of Congress after a long flight over from Japan. Who is this man?
He is the grandson of the founder of Toyota. That is a return to family control or family leadership of the company after several CEOs who were not from the family. So it's rather like Bill Ford returning family control to Ford. He's an unusual character in that he is quite outspoken. The tradition at Toyota is that they've generally been very shy of publicity. They come from Nagoya, about an hour and a half from Tokyo, not from the capital. They tend to come across as rather provincial, shy people who don't see the point of publicity. He is very outspoken. He told a group of Japanese journalists late last year that Toyota was coming towards a crisis and that it needed big changes if it was to recover. Now, this was before the recall, so I would imagine he now thinks he's really in a crisis.
And Bill Emmett, formerly from The Economist, as lawmakers read his profile and their chiefs of staff brief them about what kind of man this is, do you think after reading those profiles they choose to go at him hard as though he were the CEO of AIG, or do they treat him with deference and respect because he's come all the way from Japan?
Oh, I think they'll go after him fairly hard. Maybe a bit more deferential than with AIG or with someone from Citibank, but they will appreciate that he's come all the way from Japan. However, this is a safety issue. It's a issue of populist politics as well, and they're being lobbied probably by U.S. car makers to treat their major Japanese competitor pretty roughly. And so I think that they will give him a pretty hard time.
Bill, did you think Bill Ford has said he thinks Akio Toyota is taking this recall personally and hard? Do you think that's true?
Yes, I think he probably is. I think he is very outspoken about his company. He's very personal in his defense of it. And he genuinely thinks his company is facing a crisis. But given that they have such a reputation for quality, it really is a serious crisis for Toyota.
Well, congressional hearings like this can sometimes effectively amount to a public trial. Akio Toyota called to the carpet in Congress today, and we'll see how he's treated and how he reacts to lawmaker questioning. Bill Emmett, former editor of The Economist, who spent many years in Japan. Thank you for joining us this morning. And now let's check in on some stories we're following at 15 minutes past the hour.
The Senate is expected to pass a $35 billion jobs bill today. The bill would offer tax breaks to companies that hire new workers. It's the first of several jobs bills promised by the Democrats. Staying with jobs, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says President Obama's stimulus package created between 1 and 2 million jobs in 2009. In health care, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he may use a shortcut to get the health care bill passed. The fast-track approach is known as reconciliation. It would allow Democrats to bypass Republican opposition.
A Colorado math teacher is being hailed as a hero after he tackled a man accused of shooting and wounding two students at a middle school. The teacher, David Benke, says he had no time to fear for his life when he tackled the man as he was preparing to reload a rifle.
Saw this guy with a gun. Unfortunately, he got another round off before I could grab him.
The man is thought to have been a former student at the school. Meanwhile, a court in Italy has convicted three executives of the internet search engine giant Google. That's after a video posted online showed a group of teenagers abusing a boy with Down syndrome. The video was posted on YouTube, which Google took over back in 2006. And at the Olympics today, the bobsled finals are on the agenda. The U.S. is in the running for a medal. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we go to Vancouver for more on the Winter Olympics. We talk with New York Times Olympics editor for an on-the-ground report that's coming up in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some takeouts on the stories we're following all week. First up, a monthly poll shows a sharp drop in America's consumer confidence. Louise Story, a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Louise, what does a sharp drop in consumer confidence mean? Why did it go down so much?
Morning, Todd. You know, one thing that surprises me is that analysts were still wrong. They were expecting it to go down maybe, 1 point. It went down 11 points. And that's because all around us, people are talking about this recovery. But apparently, at least, according to this index from the Conference Board, regular people out there are just not feeling it. And this index focuses on two areas. It asks them how they think about the current environment, what things look like now, and what they expect for the future. And for both pieces, people dropped their expectations. They dropped their assessments. They said, you know, it doesn't look as good as it did the past few months.
So if people are hesitating buying that new refrigerator, buying that new washing machine, that must have implications for the broader recovery.
Absolutely, because, you know, consumer spending is about 70% of the economy. This index also asks people a lot of questions about jobs and whether they think it's easy to get jobs or not. And people said, no, it's still very hard to get jobs, and their assessments of that fell from the last few months, looking like it's a little harder for people to get jobs.
So people are skeptical about money coming in and skeptical about spending it. Louise Story, finance reporter from our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, Louise.
For our next takeout, we'll go to Vancouver for an update on the Winter Olympics. Jason Stallman is the Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning again, Jason.
Good morning.
Unexpected things happened last night. It was the big event. Everyone's been waiting for women's figure skating and some surprises on the ice.
Well, it's going to take a lot for me to kind of rein in the hyperbole here, because what happened in women's figure skating last night was absolutely unbelievable. I was trying to gain a reference point, and I think I had to go back to the Beijing Olympics with Usain Bolt that August night at the Bird's Nest when he ran the 100 meters in a time that completely floored everyone. And a similar thing happened last night at Pacific Coliseum with women's figure skating. The working press, at least, was left staggered, and I think the live audience was as well. Mao Asada, a Japanese figure skater who is a gold medal contender, performed flawlessly. She was in first place. The very next skater was Kim Yuna of South Korea, who is widely regarded as the best in the world, and she somehow one-upped her. It was a really spectacular performance that many people who've been around figure skating for a long time said it was the best they'd ever seen, and she set a world record. And then before anyone could catch their breath, Joanie Richet of Canada stepped onto the ice. This is 2 days after her mother died suddenly of a heart attack, and she had the best performance of her career. And now she's in position for a bronze medal. So a lot to process, needless to say.
The Americans were not expected to show well, but they performed well last night, did they not?
They did perform well. Marina Gasu, the very young American, she went 11th. There were 30 skaters, and she went relatively early. She had a bloody nose halfway through her routine and still finished pretty strong. And she and Rachel Flatt, the 19-year-old high school senior, they're in the running for perhaps a bronze medal. If one of the top three skaters falls or tripped up or otherwise, the Americans could come away with a bronze on Thursday night.
Okay, another big name, Bodie Miller, went to try and get his fourth medal and maybe become the first guy to get a fourth medal in alpine skiing. What happened in the giant slalom?
Well, Bodie started strong, and coming out of the gate, it was quite obvious that he was willing to take every risk he could to come away with another medal. As you mentioned, four in one Winter Olympics would be a record for alpine skiing, and he just got a little bit too audacious on the giant slalom course, and he missed a gate and couldn't regain his line, so he skied off the course. He's got one more chance, that's Saturday in the slalom, to set that record.
And we'll be watching to see if he makes it. Jason, stay awake there in Vancouver. Jason Stallman, the Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times.
For our last takeout now, we turn the microphone over to you, the listeners.
This is Dale Davidson from Manhattan.
Dale's one of our many listeners who reached out to us on Frustration Nation, our series on where we look at gridlock in Washington. And yesterday we asked, is the media to blame, and what's your big frustration moment?
My media frustration moment came back in the 80s. They decided to change the FCC ownership of radio stations and TV stations so that non-American citizens could own these. And I said, hello, Rupert Murdoch.
Now, Al emails us, Americans fall for spin doctors who use the media to get these voters to react, and then they blame the media. The Tea Party and healthcare are two prime examples. Voters get spun, and instead of blaming themselves for their own stupidity, they look around for the nearest target, and the media and the Congress are to blame.
Al was kind of in the minority among the respondents, though. Most listeners agreed with Anne from Massachusetts. She emails, we depend on the media to call politicians out for misstatements and lies. The healthcare reform issue is an example. We hear that most Americans are happy with their insurance. Then we hear 30 million people are without health insurance. Please clarify what this means.
There were also a few of you who thought like Cedric in Miami and thought the media is not wholly to blame. He posts on our site. Yesterday, your guest Kathleen Hall Jamison from Annenberg Public Policy Center said,
blaming the media for causing the problem is like blaming the family dog or the in-laws for a divorce. Small part of the problem, yes. central to the problem, no.
Cedric doesn't like that analogy. He says it's more like this. Blaming the media for gridlock is like blaming the vindictive mother-in-law who tries to pass unverified claims as facts and profits from the strife by selling ad space on her blog. Now, of course, we cannot blame her completely, but she did not help the situation either.
And, of course, we are part of the media, and one of the criticisms we received comes from Charles on our website, thetakeaway.org. I question the entire premise with this week-long series. Is there gridlock in Washington, or is there a hard and bitter debate over an overwhelmingly huge new federal health care spending bill? Is your show trying to leave listeners with a subliminal message that if there's no passage of the Obamacare bill, then Washington is guilty of a kind of institutional pathology? The answer to that, Charles, would be no. No subliminal messages.
All right. If you want to keep sticking it to the media or to us, you can do it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment on the website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, broadband access is a top priority for the White House, but even if it reaches the hinterlands, will people be able to afford it? About a third of them can't. Is broadband internet so important that the government should pay for it? That's what we're going to be talking about in just a few minutes. Stay with us.
Coming up, does everyone in America need broadband access? And if so, can we afford to get it to them all? We're going to talk about that in a few minutes, but first, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. In a little more than 2 hours, Toyota President Akio Toyoda will be called onto the carpet in Capitol Hill. He's expected to apologize for safety lapses. Earlier, we spoke to the Wall Street Journal's Kate Linebaugh, who covered yesterday's Toyota hearings, and will be back later this morning.
Potentially, this could be in Japanese translation, which would make it a whole lot longer, and that's almost hard to imagine given how long yesterday's hearings were.
Also on Capitol Hill, the Senate's expected to hand Democrats a much sought-after victory today by passing a jobs bill. Among the provisions is a tax break to companies that hire the unemployed.
Moving overseas now, an Italian court convicted 3 Google executives of privacy violations this morning because they did not act quickly enough to pull down a video that showed bullies abusing an autistic boy. Bill Eckinson, a senior communications manager at Google, says the company will appeal.
Sites like Blogger and YouTube, if they're held responsible for vetting every video, then the freedom that we know, the web we know, will cease to exist.
The case is being closely watched around the world because of its implications for internet freedom. Here at home, major cuts are coming to ABC News. The company says it plans to lay off 25% of its editorial staff. That's about 400 people. And Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke heads to Capitol Hill today to deliver his twice-yearly economic report. Let's check in on the markets now. Asian markets are down, European indices are up, and futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,292. The S&P opens at 1,094, and the NASDAQ opens at 22,213 this morning, and those are some of the stories we're following.
Does this bring back memories for you? Listen to that. That's the sound of a computer trying to connect to the internet over a telephone line. Well, if you live in a big city, it's probably been a while since you've heard that because you probably use broadband, a cable modem, and you haven't heard that squeak of the 56K modem in quite some time. But in rural America, that's probably a much more recent memory. Only a third of web surfers have high-speed hookups. 93 million Americans have no access to broadband, and now the FCC is looking to do something about that. We're joined now by Nick Zaberla. He's on the case. He's a community activist in the city of Whitesburg, Kentucky. He started a group called Dial Up Rocks that tries to address this lack of broadband in rural communities. And we're also joined by Brian Stelter, media reporter for our partner, The New York Times. And there's an article in today's paper by Brian on yesterday's FCC announcement and the kind of nuanced stance from the Obama administration on this issue. Good morning to both of you, Brian and Nick.
Good morning.
So, Brian, you wrote about this FCC announcement yesterday, and I was really interested in the categories that the FCC made. The FCC talked about the 4 categories of people who don't have access to broadband. Can you tell us what those were?
That's right. They saw that some people were very motivated to get online. They found that some people were entirely disinterested in getting online on broadband, and they found that some people just didn't have the tools to do so, and they created clever names for each of those categories. Basically, what they're trying to do is set the table for the rollout of a national broadband plan to get more and more Americans with high-speed internet.
Okay, Nick Zaberla, let me ask you, why does it matter whether somebody has dial-up or broadband? I mean, it's a good thing that most people have access to the internet at all. Does it matter if they can't stream Hulu shows quickly?
Well, I think in rural America, it's not just wanting to download Hulu shows,
but it's access to health care, students being able to do their homework, small businesses being entrepreneurial online. We see a lot of people in our community spending a great deal of time trying to get to broadband access, including a young man I have down the road from me who spends about an hour a day traveling to get to broadband access. So I think it's more about quality of life than entertainment.
Brian, the Obama administration is on board with that. They recognize that with our society, the way that our society is today, and the actually how necessary it has become to be able to access things over the internet, the Obama administration has made universal access a top priority. But how are they going to do this? How are they going to address the cost issues of setting up the kind of network that will get broadband to everyone?
What they're going to do, and they're going to, you know, they'll be releasing a plan in about a month that will outline a lot of these issues. But so far, what it seems they'll do is try to encourage innovation, try to encourage companies like Google that want to roll out ultra-high-speed access, and they will try to create a different sort of markets, test markets for this in other ways. But a lot of this is going to be trying to prod the private sector into both speeding up the existing access, the people that already have it, and then trying to reach those last miles, those rural parts of the country that don't have access yet, trying to get that there in the first place. This report found that, you know, about 12% of people that don't have broadband said that's because they couldn't get it at all. And that's going to be the hardest part.
Nick, here's the thing, though. In this FCC announcement yesterday, the thing that is surprising is that 35% of Americans don't use broadband at home, but only 4% of the people who don't have broadband want it or say that they would buy it if they had it, meaning that there are some people out there that are skeptical of the need or the cost is prohibitive of them. So how are you talking to people and actually getting to people to convince them that they need broadband?
Well, we need to think about kind of lifting all communities, and definitely if we think of children who are in those households who want an education future, we really need to think of broadband as a universal service, like we have highways, roads, electricity, and phone service, and that we can't depend on corporations or telecoms because, as here in Kentucky, they will tell you it's cost prohibitive to go that last mile. So I think we really need. I think the FCC is on the right track on providing access that's accessible, and that's including subsidies for hardware, for equipment, for people to get online.
Well, that's my next question for you, Nick. You anticipated it. What happens if that last mile is covered, and then it's just that much more expensive for people? Are you confident that subsidies will be sufficient, that it'll be worth it for people to buy it, or will it just be too expensive?
I mean, I think this is it's an investment that we need to make. If you in a rural town, it really is going to come down to the economics, where you have folks who are, you know, choosing between paying for their electric bill or, you know, buying prescription medicine. We have an opportunity in this country to really raise all ships. Is that last mile going to be affordable for everyone? No. But is it something that we need to do as a society? Definitely. We have communities here where the telecom has run the broadband access within 100 yards of people's homes, but are not willing to stretch it those final feet for cost prohibition.
And Brian Stelter, did the FCC say anything about what they call the digitally distant? These are people who are around 63 years old, 10% of the population, who say they don't see what the relevance of the internet is?
This is the part that fascinates me personally. I think what the FCC has said is that if once you're online, you understand why it's important to be online. The problem is getting those people to try it in the first place, to come online and realize it's not simply a place to get viruses and to get scammed. Certainly it's possible. Certainly you need to have some sort of education.
Try it, you'll like it, right?
Having that education is going to be an important part. But once you're online, you realize those dangers are minimal. And really, that's what sells you on it.
Brian Stelter is a media reporter for The New York Times. And Nick Zabarla is a community activist. He runs the group Dial Up Rocks, an advocacy group in Kentucky. Thanks so much to both of you. Do you dial up? Call us and tell us what that's like. If there's things that you can't do on the internet or can't access, and if you have faster connections of your broadband, could you live without your cable modem? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I, for one, I mean, I could live. Let's be honest. I could live.
Even without your Facebook?
I could live without Facebook. I mean, come on. You could live without it. But there's a lot of stuff I do. Checking my son's homework. His homework is online even. His homework assignments from his teachers. So I got to access it.
You could live without it, just not easily.
That's right.
Good morning. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry until tomorrow. Some breaking business news now about Google. Three European internet giants have complained to the European's competition regulator that Google is choking competition by unfairly listing their services lower down on your search page when you search for them. One of the companies that's complaining about Google is owned by Microsoft. We're joined now by the BBC's business correspondent, Russell Padmore, live from London to tell us more. Russell, who is complaining about Google's placement of their companies on a search page?
Well, Todd, we're talking here about three basic companies. Foundum, that's a UK price comparison website. eJustice, a French legal search engine. And Chaobing, that's effectively an Italian search engine company, which is owned by Microsoft, the company buying it fairly recently. Now, they're actually saying that Google is being a little unfair in that if you go and do a search, for example, Foundum have produced their own search of Zanussi, the Italian refrigerator company, for example, or Nokia. They did a search on the phrase Nokia 5800. If you're searching for one of Nokia's cell phone handsets, you find that Google's own services suddenly leap to the top of the search results, and their own particular company, Foundum, was well down the list. They're saying that's not right because effectively they're losing out, and Google is unfairly promoting its own products. They've asked the antitrust watchdogs in Brussels here in Europe, who run the competition regulation for the European Union, to take a look at what Google's doing, saying it's unfair competition. They're effectively promoting themselves in front of the competition.
Now, this is also about advertising, right? Because these searches get money by click-throughs. So if a company like Nokia, for instance, and I'm just using a for instance, has an advertising deal with Google and is then further up the page than a company that advertises with Foundum, it gets complicated.
Yeah, that's right. If you look at the Google page, you'll see a certain section of it is where companies are paid to put themselves at the top. Google's making money from that. You have to remember, though, as you said, that other companies can make money from online advertising simply by people coming to their site. How do they learn about you, though? They're going to go to one of these search engines, whether it's Yahoo or Google or MSN's Bing, Microsoft's Bing, and they're going to put in a key phrase and hopefully find your company at the top. And then based on that, if you are like Foundum, for example, a price comparison website, well, the amount of clicks to your website is how you earn money in advertising revenue based on how many people are visiting the site. If Google is putting its own similar service at the top of its own search page, then you're going to suffer from that. And they're saying that Google is using its might in this search engine world, the cyberspace world, to take advantage to promote itself.
Now, finally, what has Google said in response?
Well, Google says that each particular case does raise slightly different issues. They're kind of saying that they're not choking off competition. They're not trying to hurt their users or partners. It's not the case at all. Google says it always listens carefully. If someone's got a real concern, they try to work out the problem. A lot of it is around the technology, Google's saying that some of these companies might be using some kind of software that's putting them at a disadvantage. It believes its business practices do reflect its commitment to be fair and square in the market, though. These companies are saying Google needs to be neutral. It's an issue which is going to be visited on Capitol Hill. Net neutrality.
Net neutrality. Can Google be neutral? Frankly, advertising other companies that it's in competition with. Russell Padmore, BBC correspondent in London. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, we talk food like we do every Wednesday. How much do those expiration dates on labels really matter? Maybe less than you think. And we'll talk more later this hour about using the smell test, not the read test. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. Until tomorrow when he comes back, and of course I'm here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, we talk food every Wednesday. Today is Wednesday, but how unsafe are expired foods? We talk with someone who ate only expired foods for 2 weeks, and she joins us with her story and the story of her stomach in just a few minutes. Right now, here, let's check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. During congressional hearings today, Toyota's president is expected to take full responsibility for the company's safety recalls. Akio Toyoda is also expected to offer his condolences to the families of four people who died in a Toyota crash allegedly caused by a sticky gas pedal back in August. Moving overseas now, a big story out of Turkey this morning. A court in Turkey has charged seven senior military officers others with plotting to overthrow the government there. To get more on the story, we spoke earlier with BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus from London. He told us what accusations those seven military officials were facing.
Well, they are just a few, a handful of a much larger number of military figures who it is alleged have been engaged in efforts to mount some kind of military coup in Turkey. This is essentially, if you like, a kind of constitutional struggle which goes to the rather peculiar role of the military in Turkey, which sees itself as the bastion, the defender of Turkey's secular revolution. And of course now with a mildly Islamist political party in power, the AKP, so it's very much a political a battle of wills.
And do we have a sense that these particular seven officers were in the sights of the government for political reasons, or is there reason to believe they may have been plotters?
I think it's more that, I mean, we don't know what they were doing, but it's more a case of the military and this Islamist party being, if you like, at loggerheads. I think it's interesting, though, because we use this label Islamist. If you go to the AKP's headquarters, like I've been to in Ankara, you find men in sharp suits all packing BlackBerries. It looks just like any other modern political party in Western Europe. So, you know, this is a very interesting and intriguing Turkish political battle, but clearly one that threatens to overturn the calm of Turkish politics that has reigned for some years now.
That was Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC, speaking with us earlier this morning from London.
At the Olympics today, women's bobsled finals are on the agenda. The U.S. is in the running for a medal in that event. They're at 6:15 p.m. Eastern time this evening. The U.S. took a silver yesterday in the Nordic Combined Team Relay. That's a cross-country skiing event. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
Hey, that's the Fat Boys, and the Fat Boys means Wednesday, which means the food on the takeaway. Now, as more people are being forced to stretch their food dollar, a question does come to mind. Can I eat that expired soup lingering in the back of the fridge? What about that apple? It's a little soft, but is it okay? Or will I get sick if I eat it? Well, Nadia Arumugam is a food writer whose work has appeared in Slate and The Guardian and The Times of London. And that's not all. She also embarked on a project. Her diet consisted solely of expired food for a whole 2 weeks. Apparently she survived because she's sitting across from me, and she's here to tell us what she ate, what she learned, and how her stomach felt along the way. And I'm also going to ask her how it tasted. And for the science behind the experiment and the science of, frankly, older food, Dr. Ten Labuza is here. He's a food scientist at the University of Minnesota, and he's worked with the Department of Defense on food safety issues. Nadia, I want to start with you. You ate expired food for 2 weeks. Now, you look okay to me. You look healthy. You're not green, at least. Does this mean that expired food, by definition, is safe, or is there a division here? Some is safe, some isn't.
Well, you know, this might be a surprise to you, but expiration dates address the quality and freshness of your food, not safety. So when you eat cookies that have sat around for maybe 6 months too long, they might not be too tasty, but they're not going to make you sick. So in fact, there are no federal regulations that govern expiration dates, apart from infant food and baby formula. Now, you do have a few states that have rules when it comes to dairy products, but mostly almost everything else that you see in the supermarket that has a printed date on it, those are decided purely by manufacturers. So in my experiment, that I decided that I wanted to see how far my human instincts, my basic common sense, was going to take me. Now, let's not forget that food is an organic substance, and nature is going to tell us when it's not right to eat. So, for example, let's say you have a head of broccoli in your fridge. The florets are yellowing, they're getting all mushy, it's feeling very light and wrinkly. That's basically nature's warning signals to you, saying that you need to throw it out. The nutrients are depleting, it's not going to give you any value. On the other hand, let's say you have some prepared broccoli in a pack. Now, if that's a day or two past its use-by date, but it still looks very green, very fresh, the stalks are firm, the florets are tight, again, that's nature telling you that it's perfectly fine for you to cook it up and enjoy it.
So really, it might be more about the sight test and what we've always called the smell test. The smell test is a cliche. Rely on that, you're saying, rather than just what's printed on the label. Well, I want to turn this around on Dr. Labuza, because you're on the scientific end of this. Dr. Labuza, I understand you've tried seven-year-old chicken, and this was in a bunker in Washington?
Well, it wasn't in Washington, and it was seven-year-old, but it was a canned chicken.
Ah, okay, but 7 years old nonetheless.
Right.
And you've lived to tell the tale.
Yeah, and it was stored at refrigerated temperature, and so that, it tasted just as good as the freshly canned product.
Now, on the other side of this, Dr. Libuza, there are foods that we've been told never go bad, and I want to run a couple of these by you because it may not be the case with some of them. What about salt? Can salt go bad?
Well, salt, the typical table salt that you use is probably millions of years old, and it doesn't go bad unless it's high humidity. At high humidity, above 75%, then the salt will start to cake up. Okay. You'll see a wet surface on it, and it gets stuck together. And people put rice in their salt shaker, and that usually takes care of the problem.
Good point. It's in the ground for millions of years before it gets in a cylindrical shaker, I guess. Now, what about vinegar?
Vinegar has some eggs in it of what we call vinegar eels. They're little organisms, and so after a long time, you can start getting eels in it.
I'm sorry.
They're not going to make you ill.
I'm sorry. You just said eels?
That's what we call them, but they're little worms.
Little worms in the vinegar.
Right.
So you got to watch out for worms if your vinegar is old. That's counterintuitive because vinegar is supposed to be sort of a classical preservative. Now, finally, what about honey?
Honey can ferment. Yeast can get into it and cause fermentation. The Romans and the Greeks used to, in fact, allow that to happen to create an alcoholic beverage called mead.
Mead. Right, like from back in when I used to read Beowulf in high school. Well, Nadia, let me ask you. You seem to be suggesting by saying that expiration dates are put on there by the manufacturer, that this is sort of like my toothbrush when they put a blue strip on there and they say, oh, the blue strip is worn out. Get a new toothbrush. Mm-hmm. Toothbrush is perfectly fine. It still works. I use it for, I dare say, 3 years after the blue strip is worn off. Is this basically the same thing on canned food or packaged food?
Yes. I'm essentially saying use the expiration dates as a guide if you like, but ultimately don't rely on them.
Use your nose.
Use what survival skills nature has given us.
Right, we've been dealing with old food since the dawn of time, I suppose. Well, speaking of old food, you've got some with you there, so why don't you go ahead and pass it out? Now, what have you got?
I basically dug around in my fridge last night in my cupboards.
Okay.
And I have this jar of mayonnaise that I have.
All right, I'm reluctant. Old mayonnaise makes me. All right.
I had this in a sandwich 2 days ago, and I looked at it last night, and I realized that the best of use by date. May 2009, and okay. I hadn't noticed a single thing. It tasted perfectly.
Well,
to me.
Toss that mayonnaise over here,
or
you can hand it across. Now you're talking to someone, Nadia Celeste. I'm a guy. If I seem, first of all, I don't love mayonnaise. I'm taking one for the team here at the Takeaway because I don't love mayonnaise in the first place.
Just stick your finger in it.
But if I, well, it's hey, it's from May 2009. Why not? Although you're probably keeping it. I feel like I'm taking a risk. Okay, well, it tastes fine. Nadia, you know what? The takeaway for me is May 2009 for mayonnaise. You've won me over. I suppose it's okay. Thanks for coming in and educating us about old food. Nadia Arumugam is a food writer whose work has appeared in The Slate and Guardian. She had expired food for 2 weeks. And of course, Dr. Ted Libuza from the Department of Defense has worked at the Department of Defense and the University of Minnesota. Thank you both.
For more details on what to eat and what you should throw away, check out our site. Our producer, Kristen Mines, put some basic guidelines there. It's at the Takeaway.org. And while you're there, there's another bonus. A lot of news outlets have been reported that we've reached the 1,000th American casualty in Afghanistan. It turns out the actual total is lower, but much harder to pin down exactly. Producer Noah King looked at how people got this number wrong. Check it out on our site, thetakeaway.org, and click on blog. Our series, Frustration Nation, continues today, too. Being frustrated? Well, that's one thing. Lots of people say they're frustrated, but do you have a solution? Some of our listeners do.
My name is Cliff. I'm calling from Detroit. I think they should tie the pay to the work done.
Seven words from Cliff in Detroit. Still, pretty good solution there. Give us your fix at 8778-MYTAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. And as always, we're taking suggestions for who had a good week and a bad with our friends at The Week magazine. I'd like to suggest either Google or Toyota again. Top up there, not great weeks for them. We're going to look at the week's up and downs on Friday. 8778-MYTAKE. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry. Just for one more day, it's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.